Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, welcome. This week on the podcast that reboots your thinking about farming, ranching, food systems, and the people that operate them, my guest and I talk about the energy to grow food, mechanical efficiency, Walmart's Project Gigatron, and they suggest a new name for the podcast. But first, you've heard me talk about Land Trust for weeks now, and some of you may still have questions. Land Trust is an online platform that connects landowners with outdoor recreators seeking access to land in a marketplace type setting. They are the leading recreation access network for outdoor enthusiasts. Everyone benefits when rural and working lands remain undeveloped, and LandTrust works this angle three ways: partnership, community, and trust. LandTrust is all about partnership. LandTrust connects landowners with responsible recreators, offering insurance, peace of mind, and higher profits. It's the easy way to unlock your land's potential. For outdoor enthusiasts, LandTrust opens the door to affordable private land adventures. LandTrust is where community thrives. Have you ever dreamt of a place where connecting with the land strengthens your community? Land Trust makes that a reality. When neighbors share access to their land through our platform, everyone wins. Your community will benefit financially. More visitors drawn by Land Trust means your town gets a slice of the $17 billion spent annually on land access. Local businesses see a boost, and your community prospers. Guests build lasting connections. Those who visit private land through Land Trust often leave with a newfound appreciation. They gain a deeper understanding of the agricultural way of life, forging connections with the people who steward these beautiful places. Land Trust fosters empathy and a shared sense of community. It's not just about access, it's about building something bigger. Land Trust is where a handshake still means something. In today's digital world, trust can be hard to find. Land Trust brings back the old-fashioned values with a user-friendly platform. They believe in the power of a good word and keeping promises. No hidden fees, no changing rules. Landowners, you get a fair deal with built-in protection. Guests, you enjoy hassle-free access with complete transparency. Land Trust success depends on both creating positive experiences for landowners and outdoor enthusiasts. Explore Land Trust, the recreation access network built on trust. Your positive experience is our greatest reward. Sign up today at www.landtrust.com/reboot. Or by clicking the link in the show notes. My guest today is a fifth-generation farmer, an Olympic silver medalist, and a founder and the CEO of We Are Noble West. We're going to talk about nutrient density, fair compensation for producers, and we theorize about what successful agriculture operations will look like in the future. So let's lean back and have a visit with Allie Cox. Well, good morning, Allie Cox. So are you really going to make me rename my podcast?
You have two options.
Okay.
It can be called the Lean Back in Your Armchair podcast, which is what I'm going to be doing for the next 2 hours. Or it can be called the Kicking the Tires podcast because, you know, a good farmer conversation typically involves long-winded, long drawn out words. Leaning against your tailgate or your hood, kicking the mud off your boots, using your tires. So you can call it Kick the Tires.
Okay. I mean, I definitely see where you're going. So when I started a podcast, I started, you know, I thought about the name quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it took a while to get there, but I wanted to kind of reboot thinking, like a restart. Like, let's reimagine things and let's do things differently. And, you know, ranching reboot is ranching restarted. That's kind of what I was going for, but I kind of see you have a point. I mean, a lot of people tell me that they just like to put it on and kick back in the truck. And 2 hours later, they go, wow, that was an interesting conversation I just listened to. I'm not sure what they talked about, but it was interesting.
I got to tell you, I have had that experience. It's a 2-hour drive to any major airport. And that is when I actually was like, you know, now is the time for me to really dive into this podcast. And I did the same thing. And it kind of reminded me of a little bit of like old school radio, like that I remember like hearing like my grandfather listen to, kind of talk radio or, you know, something. So I appreciate it. This feels like a throwback experience. And as for somebody who goes a million miles an hour and is overscheduled and overbooked as an agency CEO, I can definitely, I'm excited for this.
Yeah, I think it took, I had to talk to a couple of your different assistants and I think, but like almost 2 months to get this one scheduled.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not bragging about this, but like a 2 hour block is definitely a, it's definitely a block. I wish things weren't like that all the time, trust me, but, you know, when you've got young children and, they've got all their activities, I try to cram in, you know, a 50 hour work week into much less time during the week. So anyway, we're good.
Okay. Well, what is We Are Noble West? And tell me a little bit about what you do.
Okay. WeAreNobleWest.com is our website URL. It's also where you can find us on Instagram at We Are Noble West. And the name of my agency is Noble West. And we rebranded to Noble West a year ago. Exactly. This is our anniversary. So, but I've been in business since 2007, which is when I told corporate America in New York, you know what, I'm going to do it my way. I come from fifth generation farming on both sides of my family. And I have never known anybody in our family to ever have a corporate job or get a paycheck from anybody other than themselves and their hard work. So risk is not something that scares me, for better or worse, right? So in 2007, after a couple different New York City marketing and advertising jobs, I thought, you know what, I can do this. And that's when I started out. And at the time, it was called Allie Cox and Company. And my name's Allie Cox. And I remember when I first came home from for Christmas from New York to Central California, back to the ranch, my dad's like, oh, this is great, honey, you know, but who's the and company? Do you have employees? And I said, no, but the and company are my freelance partners and everybody I know, everybody I partner with to get things done. And he's like, okay, I'm not sure I understand it, but if anybody can make anything happen, it's you. I mean, let's also keep in mind that 3 years earlier, I won a medal at the Olympics. So he really is sort of like, you got to be really careful the challenges that you give Allie Cox because
wait, back up.
Yeah.
You said you won a medal at the Olympics.
I did.
Okay.
I did.
in what?
Rowing.
In
the women. Rowing in the women's eight. And you're from Kansas. I got to tell you, state of Kansas, like KU and KSU, they've invested in their rowing programs for women. I think they're both actually tied through Title IX. I think they both actually went D1.
I did.
I rode with a couple women from KSU at development camp.
Okay. I know I've seen like competitive rowing, like four people in a boat and you're like going. Like there's more to it than that.
Or two or eight or one.
Okay. Which event did you do?
The women's eight.
The women's eight. So you're part of eight man boat crew.
Well, let's call it woman.
Sorry.
And the coxswain. So there's technically nine human beings in the boat, eight of which are rowing backwards and one of which is steering the boat and team captain.
And your coxswain steers like, yeah. Does he call cadence to keep you guys in time?
She,
sorry.
Oh, Brian, I'm going to correct you for 2 hours. So buckle up.
I'll figure it out. I promise.
Yes, there is a magnet that is typically just taped to the bottom of the seat in front of her. And so she can see the cadence of the stroke rate that's called, the person sitting in front is called the stroke, that the stroke has. So that way she can see the strokes per minute and see if that aligns with number one, the race strategy, because we have a strategy going into the race, because by that time you know which stroke rates you actually move the boat the fastest. It sometimes is not the highest or the lowest, or, you know, typically for most races, like at the collegiate or international level, you're rowing at like 35, 36 strokes a minute. If you've got a really big, strong crew that's like actually bigger in stature, it might be 34. If you've got a small scrappy crew of like smaller people who are maybe a little lighter, it could be higher. It could be 36 or 37. But yeah, so she's keeping track of that and steering the boat, and also she has a microphone, and there are little speakers throughout the boat. And so she is basically kind of like the on the water coach, cheerleader, captain, motivator, executing the race plan. It's pretty awesome.
Okay. You said that the one person in the boat is a stroke. Did they kind of set the pace? Is that where they put the strongest rower?
Probably the technically the strongest rower. And some people just have really great rhythm, right? You know, like a dancer. Like they just have great rhythm, right? And that can happen with rowing too. Like they just really feel the water really great and they have good technique and they have a really nice cadence to follow. They're just really technically super strong. That doesn't necessarily, that's probably where you're not putting your physically the strongest person. You're probably putting like the strongest technical rower. Or the most aggressive. Honestly, that's the other thing. Or the most aggressive. You definitely have got a gamer up there, like somebody who's super competitive. Not that we are at that level. All of us are like voraciously competitive, but like you've definitely got like somebody who has too big of an ego to lose.
So how did you get into rowing?
I mean, in canal ditches throughout the farm, obviously, Brian. No, I'm just kidding. in the canals. No. I got into rowing. I walked on the University of San Diego women's rowing team my sophomore year of college. But honestly, the coach saw me walking on campus and she's like, "Who are you? Can you please come try out for rowing? You just look like a natural athlete." And I'm 6 feet tall, very long arm, big wingspan.
To pull a big oar.
A lot of arm, long legs, strong legs. You know, I was a 12-time letter woman in high school in, pretty big high school. So as far as sports go, like I love to be coached. I love to be on a team. I like to be the team captain, or I also don't mind being like just, you know, a teammate to people as long as I believe in the team captain's vision. Like I've just really liked to win as a team and I'm happy to do that in any role there is. I also feel like that now as a CEO of the agency, like I'll play whatever role I have to in order to, to help us win the deal or win the client over or whatever. I walked on and then I just had this real physical kind of emotional, spiritual aptitude for it, honestly.
So how did that turn into making a run at the Olympics?
Well, have you ever heard of the ergometer, that rowing machine that's like in gyms?
Nope.
Oh, Brian. So you could Google Concept 2. It's an ergometer. There's lots of different ones made, but that's the one that most testing is done on. Concept 2. And so the rowing machine, I was on it. And then my scores, like my numbers that I was hitting were really, really strong. And so you submit your scores. And then that helps you get into indoor races. And then you can start proving out like kind of how strong you are in your way. And then from that test, I was able to see, get invited to development camps and get invited to different opportunities to race against women from different schools and then compete on the national team. So I went to the Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista. I was invited. I was like 40 women invited from around the country. And I came from a really small school. Like there's only like 3,000 or 4,000 people at our college. So it's a tiny school. But, you know, an athlete's an athlete. Like it doesn't really matter how big of a school you come from. If, you know, if you're a good athlete, you can, that typically always proves out. And so I made the development camp, and this is like, we're talking about like 23 years ago. So let's also keep this context.
I get that. Yeah. That's like, I mean, when people ask me about the Navy, I'm like, that was a whole lifetime ago. Give me a minute.
And that was for me, that was like three other lives ago with like, you know, that's before like children and everything. And so I was invited again, like 40 women, and they were doing selection for 4 seats in a boat to go to under 23 world championships. And I beat out a whole bunch of women that went to like, that were on the junior national team, that went to these super fancy schools with huge rowing programs like Princeton and Yale and Harvard and Washington and Cal and Michigan. And I mean, it was pretty great. And then I was like one of four, and I had like no idea what I was doing except for pulling really hard and doing everything I could to be a good teammate and listen to those coaches. And then I ended up making it. And then from there on, I just kept getting faster and faster and faster on the rowing machine and more fit. And rowing is one of the hardest sports. So because it requires both aerobic and anaerobic capacity, like you have to be super strong and you also have to be super fit. Kind of like the 400 hurdles or something, you know, you're sprinting the whole time, but then you also have these hurdles, these jumps to jump that are like take power to get over it, right? It's a similar sort of lactic acid, utilization or whatnot.
Well, not that I work out a whole lot, but
okay,
like a rowing machine has, it's my understanding that a rowing machine is like a lot of a full body workout.
Yeah, for sure. It's also great, like for all of you listening to this podcast, if you have serious knee injuries just from years of hard work and wear and tear and or running or whatever. Yeah. If you have terrible knees, get yourself a rowing machine or go to the gym and get on that, because you can get a full body workout with zero pressure on your knees.
Yeah, because you're not, your foot's not slamming down on the ground.
No, you just need to make sure that you technically are rowing proficiently so you don't hurt your back. That's like the biggest thing.
Okay. So you're on an 8-woman team in college. Was that still an 8-woman boat in the Olympics, or was that a 4-woman boat?
I made the 8. There are 4-women boats. There's a quad, and then there's the straight 4, and the straight 4 means that there's no coxswain. But I made the 8.
Is there really a big difference between the two? In how you have to row and how you have
No, but there's like a difference in boat speed. There's a difference in jobs. You know, like if you're in the straight 4, like the person sitting, you know, in the back, they're actually looking over their shoulder to tell you like if you're going to hit something or like where to go. If you're sitting, this person second to the, like it right in front of them is actually the in coxswain. Like they would be the one yelling the like go or yet like grunting like the calls that you already know are coming. The person in front, the stroke actually has, the rudder is connected to a wire that's connected to your shoe, and you're actually using your foot to steer.
Okay. So,
but it's really a fun boat because it's really fast because you don't have any extra weight. But the 8 is where you just put like your hammers, like your strongest people just like pull as hard as you can and stay in the rhythm. And because the coxswain will do all the steering work.
Did they put the smallest person in the boat as a coxswain?
Yeah, they... Like in women's rowing, they weigh 110 pounds.
Oh, wow.
In men's rowing, I think they weigh maybe like 120, 125, 120.
Okay.
So little folks, like a jockey. And honestly, the personality of a jockey, like they're aggressive as hell. They just are tiny people.
Okay. So after the Olympic hangover, what happened?
Oh, that's a good, figuratively and literally.
That was a lot of training and a lot of buildup. And then the Olympics happen. And then it's like,
oh my God. It's like the amount of like weddings and birthdays and at family events I met. I mean, I have memories of like when I was in training, like I'd come home for Christmas and like my family would like, say, watch a movie like together. I would be on that ergometer. We'd put it in the living room, and I would be on that thing for the whole 2 hours that movie was going. Everybody else is laying on the couch. Just in the running and the lifting and stuff. So, yeah, that is, we had 4 practices a day in the Olympic year. AM1, AM2, PM1, PM2, and then typically like 3 practices on Saturday, maybe 1 on Sunday. And then we'd get like Wednesday afternoon off or something.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Well, I mean, honestly, if you're going to perform at the top level.
Yeah.
You've got to put the work in.
Yeah. I think the funniest thing though was our coach, he was, Your morning warm-up jog. I don't know. Okay, Brian, here's a question to you. If you're going to do a warm-up before a practice, how long do you think the jog would be?
I don't know, 10 minutes?
Yeah, okay. Sure. Warm up the joint. It was 3 miles. Then you're like, okay, so this is like actually another workout. Okay, got it.
Yeah. I mean,
and then of course you've got
20 minutes, right?
And then of course you've got the most competitive people. So why not make that into a sprint?
Well, of course. It's got to be a race. Everything's got to be a race.
Yeah. Well, anyway, those were good days. So after that, your question, I interviewed for a job in New York City. We had one day off in the summer of 2004. And I went to New York City. We were training in Princeton, New Jersey. And I went to New York and I interviewed for a job. And then I got that job. And then after the Olympics, after closing ceremonies and everything, I went back to New Jersey. I packed up a U-Haul. I drove myself through the Lincoln Tunnel. And I moved into a tiny apartment with a friend who was a rower at Princeton. She just had graduated. She was a rower at Princeton University. And I moved into an apartment in the Upper West Side. And I started working at IMG doing entertainment and sports marketing.
Okay. So how did you get from there to Noble, to Allen Cox & Co., which became We Are Noble West, and working back in agriculture?
Well, lots of fast-forwarding is done there. But in 2013, I had already been like the founding director of marketing for an online TV company. I'd already been the director of sponsorship and marketing for Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week in New York. I had already done a lot of entertainment marketing in like a short window, but I decided it was time for me to actually, I just was sick of marketing fashion and entertainment and technology. And I just like really, really decided it's time for me to go back to my roots. It's time for me to go back to what I care about. Like I knew I loved marketing. I knew I loved advertising, but what I didn't love was the industries that I was doing it in at that point. So I, you know, being a fifth generation farmer on both sides, I knew I wanted to come back and market something I care about, which is agriculture.
And I was taking notes and I was thinking, did you have a problem with the consumptive consumerism of that system and wanted to get back to something more real?
No, I think it wasn't necessarily more real because I believed in what I was doing. It was very real to a lot of people that work in those industries. Like those are real hard workers. There's a lot of smart people in those industries. It was intellectually challenging. So it wasn't necessarily real, but it was more just based on my values, right? Like I just saw how hard my family's always worked to grow melons and sell melons and grow tomatoes and almonds and beans and beef cattle. And I just know how hard the family works. And, you know, I worked on the family ranch for my whole life until I went to college. And it's so to me, it's not necessarily that it's like more real. It just is more aligned with my values. And I just saw the need for somebody who cares as much as I do and has, quite frankly, the talent that I do in marketing and like creative and strategy. And I could really make a big impact.
Okay.
And the truth is, being in New York, like I was around foodies all the time. Amazing restaurants, great chefs, like food matters so much. It's restaurant culture, right? And I had so many smart friends and amazing people, and they really didn't know where their food came from. And every time my dad would come visit, it'd be like a little celebrity situation, like, Jack, what's wearing on the ranch? And, you know, like they were so impressed with how smart he was, because he's a brilliant man. And that just sort of like, it was such an aha moment of like, man, even the smartest people who care the most about restaurants and food don't actually know where or how this is grown and how agriculture plays a part in food. And agriculture and food are so disconnected to the majority of humans that's a place where I just thought, gosh, I don't think that they're going to miss me in fashion or tech or sports. They're not going to miss Allie Cox, but I think that if I left ag marketing right now, I think it'd be really sad for a lot of people, and it would be sad for me too.
One of the comments you just made, agriculture is disconnected from food.
Totally.
I love that. I so much love that. Because mm-hmm. when I think about agriculture and farming. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, you know, I'm in Kansas, so I have a little bit different of a lens than in Central Valley, California. Agriculture in Kansas growing up was wheat. And as I was growing up, corn and soybeans, you know, really started to replace wheat. I saw, you know, a lot of people get irrigation pivots 20, 25, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're not even really over the aquifer. We're not over the big Ogallala aquifer that everybody talks about in the plains. Like, we're at the very, very, very end of it. Okay. And, you know, cattle were always big growing up. Uh-huh. And what I've seen happen is going from, you know, predominantly wheat-based agriculture in Kansas, the wheat state, right? Which, okay, most wheat grown goes to end up as a human edible product. I mean, a lot of it ends up as enriched wheat flour, whatever. We could talk about how, you know, enriching things and what's been done to the food. But what I'm getting at is, you know, now we're growing corn and soybeans, which, okay, they're crops. But what eats number two dent corn and what eats soybeans? Humans don't eat soybeans unless they're processed. And the soybeans that we grow in the field, they're basically cow food. The number two dent corn that we grow, it primarily has two uses. It can go to a feedlot / dairy, or it's going to go to an ethanol plant. And yes, soybeans end up at an ethanol plant too. And those byproducts, you know, the spent distiller's grains, they end up back in the cattle commodity food supply chain, right? So I wonder, like, farming and agriculture should be growing food. Uh-huh. Not, and it seems really odd to me that we're going to grow corn in Iowa and ship it to the panhandle of Texas to feed cows standing in a pen. That doesn't seem right to me. And I'll go ahead and say this. I've said this before. If you're not growing anything that ends up on your table, are you really a farmer?
Yeah, and that's where I'm going to challenge you all day, Brian, because think about it. Fiber. Can't forget about fiber. The clothes, your sweatshirt that you're wearing, you know, like that, that's all comes from ag.
Yes.
Yep. And so I think that...
I'm actually not wearing plastic clothes today, so it's mostly cotton.
You know, that's ag. So there's a lot of, you know, we have an advisor at the agency and she's very well versed in really all the legislative things. And I mean, what about the fact that like we're sending our trash to China to landfills? We're also sending our cotton that we grow here to oftentimes China or some of those other Asian countries to make clothes.
Southeast Asia, okay. Where labor's cheap.
And then we are then buying them back, and then we're selling them here. We're using them till we don't want them anymore. They become trash, and then it goes back. Like, if we were, and that is, and then my question is, like, where do the farmers fit into all that? And so there's just that from an environmental standpoint, there's a lot there, but there also is a lot of progress. Now, this is when you're going to be like, why did we let the crazy Californian on this thing? But there's also a lot
of the crazy Californians on. You're fine.
There also is a lot to be said, though, for what's happening in more progressive, call it environmentalism or in the name of climate control or whatnot. But a lot to be said for, like, we are working on upcycled fruit projects right now, like how actual grayed out and cold, like what would normally be a cold or a grayed out or imperfect, how it's actually getting utilized in the food system and fragrance and fashion system. We're working on that. There's also, I mean, there's a great collaboration that was just announced last week between Veuve Clicquot, the champagne company in the south of France, and Stella McCartney, a very, a super popular fashion designer from London. They are taking like the actual skins from the grapes after they're being juiced and making handbags from them. I mean, so there are more, but like my question, this is what I want to like really dive in. And this is where I think farmers need better advocates and who understand consumer behavior. Because again, that goes back to like the ag and farming is like ag and food. Like I always say, there's an ocean between consumers and farmers. Farming is like one of the only industries where like, this might sound a little like tongue-in-cheek, but like farmers actually hate their customers because they don't know what they want because they're never given the information. Like, oh, what do they want now? Now they want it to be regenerative. What does that mean? You know, oh, now they want organic. Ah, what does that mean? You know, that's where like, and then it always comes back to, they're just going to make their choices on price. Well, that's not always the case. And I just think that that's where our job at Noble West is to help tell those proper stories and give farmers more voice so that they can get closer to consumers. And also vice versa, a lot of consumers just have questions. They want to know where their food comes from. And quite frankly, can you blame them? No.
No.
But we do all the time.
And let's be honest. 100,000 head chicken barns, 50,000 head hog barns, 25,000 head cattle dairies.
Yep.
Bigger. That's why the vegans have an argument about animal welfare.
Oof. Yeah.
You know, so going back, you were talking about trash, plastic trash, okay. Single-use plastic.
Uh-huh.
And I think about that in the context of how much food is wasted. Okay, we talk about how wonderfully productive American agriculture is, which is great. You know, we're great at, quote, feeding the world a bunch of commodities. We're not so great at feeding our communities actual nutrient-dense food, which is, like, really love to change that. But I think the figure is something like 40% of food is wasted, just gets thrown away, ends up in a landfill, whatever.
Yeah.
And I think about how much single-use plastic that food is wrapped in and packaged in. And how much of that gets discarded, which it's an important part of the conversation. And it's important from the sense that, you know, we need to reduce our oil usage, right? Okay. Well, growing food takes a lot of that. Growing food takes a lot of energy. And if we're going to reduce our demands on oil, we need to like reintroduce more human labor back into the food system. But the single-use plastic, we're making the single-use plastic to wrap a perishable item in out of oil that's been in the ground for 100 million years and takes energy to produce that plastic, and there's waste products, and it doesn't degrade in the environment. And we use it once and throw it away. Like you mentioned, we would ship our recyclables to China. That was a thing for quite a while. We'd ship all our plastic waste over there. They'd be like, oh, yeah, we'll take it. I think it's been within the last 4 or 5 years, the Chinese said, we're not taking it anymore. We're not taking any of your plastic trash anymore. We're not even going to try to recycle it because they realized it wasn't being recycled. And I think that's a dirty truth that most plastics that are recyclable, a very, very, very tiny percentage of them get recycled.
We could talk about food waste. We could also talk about waste. Like, it's not recycled. And that's where, unless you live, like, in California, which is probably where this is the most progressive state, obviously, when it comes to, like, environmentalism. And unless you're living in, like, the most progressive cities, like, or areas like Marin County, which is outside of San Francisco, or Santa Clara, which is where, near where Stanford is, like those, there are really, that's when you're sorting your trash by like five different ways. Like nothing stresses me out more than going to stay with our friends in Marin. Cause I'm like, oh my God, what do we do with our trash? And then, and like they get fined if there's one thing in the wrong bin. But you know what? It's really like a zero waste society because they are actually doing it. I mean, how many of us like take off the labels off of, take the label off of whatever the jar or the plastic that it came in and threw the label in the trash in the plastic and the recyclable? I mean, nobody. We're not trained to do that.
Well,
and I agree. We've been lied to for about 50 years from the plastic industry.
And I get that. And there are places in the world and even in the country that have effective recycling programs. But, you know, when you have your blue recycle bin and your normal black trash can and the same trash truck picks both of them up and puts them in the back.
Like Mike.
They're not recycling anything. All that shit's going to the landfill. You're just having to pay extra for the blue can and the recycling fee every month. And they're just throwing it away in the landfill.
Do you want to take on the garbage lobbyists? Is that what you're looking to do?
I have no interest in getting involved with organized crime, the mafia, or the mob. Thank you very much.
I don't think they're all the mafia or the mob. I'm going to be careful what I say. But yeah, it's a... The only way it's going to change, though, if consumers say, you know what, enough's enough. But I just don't think that that's just not where... I don't think that's a fight where most people are educated enough to do or self-educated or have awareness. It's not covered in the press enough. And that's why, like, I would never call myself necessarily an environmentalist. That's, I don't think, how I align. But there's something to be said for, like, I appreciate those folks. You know what I mean? They're, while I'm not sure if it's all truth, they're uncovering issues that, like, that do matter. And the other thing is, I think that it also sheds a light on an area that kind of takes some heat off of farmers being, you know, kind of the villains when it comes to climate, which I don't agree with in lots of different ways.
Well, I mean, we can look at that through several different lenses. And I think that it's hard to talk about because you don't want to say bad things about farmers, but at the same time, there's a lot of them that could be doing things a lot better. You know, how many places in the Midwest have problems with nitrates in their water from fertilizer runoff?
Yeah.
Okay, great. You can't point to a single farmer and say, your fertilizer runoff has poisoned this water. But generally, like, it's an area. It's like all the use of all the nitrogen excess nitrogen fertilizer has run off and has caused this in this area. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to go to an individual farmer in an area like that and say, hey, you got to stop doing this.
Yeah. Or
tell everybody in the area we need to stop doing this for water quality, because when you get down to it, it's like, you know, and we're getting ready to talk about regenerative agriculture here in just a second, I promise. But it's like talking to farmers about, okay, have you tried this? Have you done no-till? Have you tried cover crops? Have you, you know, reduced your tillage? Well, no, I can't because this, 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 and this. It's like there's always a long line of reasons of why they can't change or why they need to do things the way they're doing them or why they need to continue a practice.
Well, I don't know, though. I'm going to just jump in there for a minute, Brian. Sure, there's a long line of excuses and equipment and all the rest of it. Let's talk about, like, the number one reason why. They are only compensated on yield and nothing else.
Yes.
In our case. I mean, and again, I'm coming to the lens that we have no subsidized crops in California, right? They're all specialty crops. None of them are subsidized. So that's an education I need to have, is like how that works on a more granular level across the Midwest. But like in our, like they're only covered, like our farmers are only, they're only compensated based on yield. So if that's the case, is that really their problem to learn how to do that? Like, should they just do that out of the goodness of their heart or because like an ethical or value? And that's where I think the problem like continues to cycle and cycle, is like, again, villainizing and pointing the finger at farmers and say like, you don't care. Like, you're a bad person. No, they care. They're not bad people. They're just not compensated. And I don't really know too many other industries in the world where as long as you are working within your compliant, you are legally in the right. I don't know too many other industries where you just do something that costs more money because you think you should, because it's the right thing to do. I just like that is maybe that's contentious, but I just don't know of any more, unless you have a customer that's willing to pay for it. I don't know why you do it. Now, if you want to like look on a similar kind of crop, if we look at oats, there's a whole revolution happening in oats. And I'd say Oatly, the oat milk company, they're driving it, right? They are saying oat milk matters. Our brand matters. We are willing. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the contract presentations that they're giving to farmers about if you farm this way, if you have it processed this way, this is then you would be a prime, like you'd be a prime Oatly oat farmer. Like, unless you've got a brand behind you, and remember, brands have direct access to consumers. They're not working with brokers. They're working directly with the farmers. And in that case, the farmers are being audited by this brand, and they are also being compensated for it. You get the right cover crop, you get the right rotational crop, you pay your people this much, so you have social responsibility, but all this stuff, you know what, we're going to give you a premium for your oats, and we're going to give you a long-term contract. And a farmer would be like, oh, yeah. Oh my God, sure. Sign me up. I already grow oats. Yeah, I can make those changes. It's going to cost about, you know, $1 million of on-farm charges if I amortize it over this contract of 6 years. Why wouldn't I? That's an investment farmers will make. But if you just tell them to make a change because they should, that's bullshit.
And I get that. And some of the folks that I've talked to in the podcast and some of my friends that grow, let's just say, not commodity crops out here in the High Plains.
Yeah.
I have a friend in Northeast Colorado. He supplies a lot of edible dry beans and mung beans, things like that to restaurants in Colorado.
Yeah.
And like even some like, I'm going to screw this up. Roy, don't send me any hate mail, but like there's some, some weird barley that he grows that there's a buyer in Canada that's like, The first time he grew it, like they said, we'll take 2 truckloads. And he sent them 2 truckloads. And the next year they're like, we will buy all of it that you will grow.
Yeah.
And.
Okay.
Roy won't put all his eggs in one basket. Even if he's got somebody that says, I will buy all of this, you will grow. He's not going to plant his whole farm to that, grow all that. He likes to grow about 10 different things and have a broad client base. So you were talking about Oatly and oat milk. And I'm not into any of the nut milks or vegetable milks or anything. Milk comes from a cow. Like there's no tit on an almond. Okay. You can't show me the mammary gland on an almond. Okay.
You know, in California, what they call a dairyman?
What?
An almond farmer.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely when the price of almonds was, you know, $3 to $4 a pound. But now the prices of almonds are in the toilet. But I don't know one dairyman that doesn't farm almonds also. Not one. And I live in Turlock, California. Hillmar is 10 miles down the road, largest cheese plant in the world. And
Okay, what I was getting at is...
You don't want to debate the meaning of milk?
I'll give my opinion. My opinion is if it comes out of a mammary gland, it's milk. If it comes from an almond, it's something else.
You know, what my opinion is?
What's that?
Give consumers all the information they need and let them make the decision, because that's what business is. That's what the economy is.
I agree, but calling it milk is deceptive. I mean, calling something from an oat milk is deceptive. And my argument would be, is the energy and water usage to make a gallon of oat milk or almond milk, is that more or less of an energy and water investment than to make cow's milk? And what is the environmental impact between the two? Where I go is any product that needs artificial processing and energy inputs is inherently less efficient than a natural product, because we're subsidizing that process with stored energy in the form of oil and hydrocarbons. There's no way you're going to make oat milk without hydrocarbons. I can make cow's milk without a drop of diesel fuel.
But, I mean, pasteurization, you also can't sell. I mean, raw milk, I think, is making a comeback. It's definitely not mainstream. But, and there's all sorts of disclaimers and everything else about it. But, I mean, at scale, I don't know if that proves out.
Scale's always the problem.
Yeah.
Scale's the problem.
And that's what I care about, is educating consumers and farmers at scale. That's why, like, CSA marketing, farmers market marketing, I think it's all fantastic. I go to the farmers market every Saturday, but, like, that's not the food system. Food system's down the road at Walmart. Hey, question for you, Midwest friend.
Okay.
Do you do you have any friends that are growing Kernza?
Not off the top of my head, but I am familiar with the crop. I think that's going to be more popular. I think there's more guys kind of in the north and northeast part of the state that are doing that. For those that aren't familiar with Kernza, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Allie.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a perennial wheat.
Yep. Exactly.
Like, it's pretty tall, it's really deep rooted, and it yields relatively well. I'm not sure what all you can use the actual Kernza berries for. I do remember that there's a brewery here in Kansas that was making beer from Kernza grain.
Yeah. So Kernza, I just learned about it 3 weeks ago. I'd never even heard of it. Deep roots, like five or six feet down roots. Like, I think you mentioned perennial crop.
Yep.
And the most apparent, I learned about this at Climate Day at Expo West. Okay. So just think about who the audience is there. I go there to learn what I want to learn. And there are quite a few brands, including Patagonia Provisions Food, the new food in our food company coming out of Patagonia. They have a Kernza pasta. General Mills is exploring it. Lots of kind of climate focused food innovation is happening with Kernza. They can't find enough growers to farm Kernza. Apparently, like, Patagonia's got two guys and they're their dudes, and they're also processing it. I guess processing it is quite something, or milling it's quite something. But they're saying that this is an opportunity for the wheat farmers to, it's an opportunity for wheat farmers to, like, kind of get on, like, the climate bandwagon, if that's something they care about. But I think we're going to see a lot of innovation in Kernza. I even asked my husband, I was like, can we start growing Kernza? Because I'd love to call Patagonia myself. And it's something that, you know, we've sort of briefly talked about.
And something that's worth kind of noting when we're talking about these crops like Kernza and trying to get a specialty market, you don't need to have 5,000 acres of it in order to be marketable. Like, some of these companies will only buy like a truckload of that grain a year, but they might pay $50,000 for that 1,000 bushels of grain versus $5,000 that you're going to get taking it to your elevator.
Which I feel like we should also talk about. That's also likely a limited, like, if a brand wants to create, do R&D packaging marketing around something like Kernza, they're going straight to the farmer. They want to know everything about their farmer. That farmer's going to be in their marketing. This is this point, like we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. This is when farmers get paid to market. Like, if I'm a farmer and I get a video crew's coming on my ranch and it's like, oh God, we got to put everything away. We got to tidy up. You're going to spend a whole, you know, you're going to spend a week and a half cleaning the ranch. Now, in order to come, but they're also going to be getting compensated for that. They're going to see that return, right? And that's where I just think that's kind of why I like that direct-to-farmer model. And it can't happen in a lot of ways unless you've got really great, you know, smaller dryers and mills and processors and elevators and all that.
Yep. I wrote down that grain milling was the bottleneck.
And oh, I'm sure.
Somewhere, I think that there's dozens, maybe even hundreds of companies out there that are screaming and begging for a specialty crop like Egyptian holeless barley or spelt or, you know, some heritage turkey red wheat.
Yellow peas came up a lot at Climate Day.
I've been hearing like yellow peas. I think I've heard that too. Yellow peas for soil.
So the context is a lot of conversation at Expo West was around, and Expo West, just for people who aren't familiar, an enormous natural foods 5-day trade show that happens every year in Anaheim. There's also Expo East, but Expo West is the biggest. 100,000 people come. Anybody who has any sort of artisanal brand is going to be launching there. All the food buyers are there. The first day of it is called Climate Day, and that's where more brands that are like kind of more climate specific as part of their messaging, that's where they really are. The woman who runs organic from General Mills, super bright woman, definitely passionate. You can see that she's walking the walk and talking the talk internally at General Mills. And she was saying how just really, really, they learned through a lot of testing that consumers, they'll make the majority of their choices based on price, convenience, and taste. Now, sustainability and climate forward messaging is a very distant fourth. Yet there is enough data to prove that it matters to a lot of consumers out there, right? And so assuming those three keys are all aligned. She said that what they have learned, they've had a couple hits and misses with different brands where they put too much climate-focused messaging on it. But what they're really learning is that behind the scenes, as part of their supply system, they can really make the most impact. And something that they've really been focusing on is finding uses for farmers who they believe in their farming practices and they're great suppliers for their rotational crop. So, you know, whatever the nitrogen fixing crop is, like a lot of times, like I work heavily in the bean industry in California. So for us, it's a lot of beans, right?
Legumes generally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like we're rotating tomatoes, beans, like all the time. There's a lot of beans lima beans are used as cover crop through almond orchards for us out here. But really, yellow peas. They have done enough R&D at General Mills that they are putting yellow pea protein paste into their like mac and cheeses and whatnot to add number one more protein, number two more as a market for their farmers. So I just think that that's a really dynamic conversation, quite frankly, and that's where, like, you know, there's lots of Debbie Downer conversations about ag, especially right now. Specialty crops are all in the toilet at the moment. It's tough. It's a tough market for sure. But that is a place where I do get a lot of hope. It's like, I think that we're starting to see more brands integrated into this. And even at the retail level. So.
Very cool. Very cool. I need to recycle a little bit of coffee. So I need to take a quick break. Is that all right?
Please.
All right. We'll be right back.
Okay.
And we're back. You know, a thought occurs to me. I keep taking these breaks to turn coffee back into water. Mm-hmm. To get sponsored by a coffee company.
Why don't you?
I'm working on it. Working on it. So what a regenerative agriculture.
Yes.
It can be kind of a broad thing, maybe kind of nebulous things. Sometimes it's difficult to pin down a definition. So how are you defining regenerative agriculture?
Okay. I feel much more comfortable talking about how to market our clients who are doing regenerative farming practices, because I don't think this is my definition to say. But, you know, I think really right now, regenerative is crop by crop. The most aggressive and ambitious regenerative farming practices, I think, have come out of the Midwest. I think just because there's more predictability in crops, it's very challenging with specialty crops to identify and best practices. But in general, it is low or no till. It is taking extra care of the soil, utilizing some sort of probiotic, really paying attention to like biological uses, typically low pesticide use. There's definitely anything we can do to keep carbon sequestered is definitely the majority of it. Now, there are trials in produce. There are trials happening in Salinas Valley right now. Cal Poly San Luis Obispo has been doing quite a bit of innovation. I know UC Davis Ag Extension has as well. There is quite a bit of innovation happening. So that's in produce, which is in most cases in the Salinas Valley, which is basically the salad bowl of the United States. That's where you're getting like 3 or 4 harvests per produce crop, because it's typically like a 2-month crop. Then they go, they till, they rip and till, and then replant, bed it up and replant. And that typically is, I think, exploring like, okay, do we really need to till 2 to 3 feet? Can we do it, you know, 6 or 7 inches? How much difference will that make? How do we measure this amount of carbon that's sequestered? Those are really some of the things that we're really looking at in produce. Now, in almonds, where I feel probably a little bit more educated, just because there's been more done through a couple different nonprofits, that's where we're really typically putting animals in the orchard. So a lot of almond farmers have become lamb and sheep herders as well. And so kind of rotating animals throughout, which has been great for grazing. Of course, you have to, like, food safety, obviously, is something that's in California is highly regulated, which I don't have a problem with in most cases. But like, so for example, in an almond orchard, I know that within 90 days of harvest, you can't have any animals in there. So that's real. Again, I think it's much more case by case, but I think with like the big Midwest row crops, there's been a lot more research that's been done. And there are a couple nonprofits that, quite frankly, are just amazing, that are doing a lot of research in the area. And I always I always bring a very curious and like judgment-free approach to innovation and farming, you know, like, but I always have the same questions, like, how are farmers going to be compensated more for this? Have consumers been educated what this is? Why are we expecting farmers to make millions of dollars of on-farm changes without having any sort of expectation of what the ROI is going to be? You know, I think it's just something that I'm kind of always looking towards.
Okay. I think the reason why a lot of innovation is coming out of the Midwest, you know, we had guys like Dave Brandt over in Ohio. Uh-huh. And just for you, for context, like, I'm pretty familiar with the plains. I mean, from the Front Range to I-35, from Montana to Texas, that's my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And I see more farmers on the western side of that area changing faster.
Really?
And what I think that is, they've got to feel the pain. They've got to feel the pain. They've got to feel the struggle, and they've got to see that the system just isn't working for them. Like the greater commodity system that the land grant universities here promote.
Yep.
And they're seeing, you know, who was it that said this? Somebody said the more on approach, not more on, the more on, we're going to put more of this on to make it grow. That seems to be the answer that, you know, the agronomists, the crop consultants, extension, NRCS, that everybody wants you to do. It's just, well, here, have this jug. It'll solve all your problems. Mm-hmm. And more guys are rejecting it. And the guys that are rejecting it more are from the drier parts. So they're feeling the pain of limited water, of the water being harder to get a hold of. And a lot of the focus in what we'd think of as regenerative agriculture in Western Kansas, Eastern Colorado, kind of the Central Plains, is about how do we crop in a dry environment and design our crop systems for soil fertility and for moisture holding? Because when you only get 14 inches of rain a year, you've got to keep it all.
Yeah. And there is data that shows that if your soil is healthier, you are going to absorb so much more of that water. I mean, there's proof. There is data that is like, I mean, I've seen the moisture soil. I've seen the soil samples happen before my eyes. Like you go across the street and they'll, you know, hammer in a moisture probe, take it out of the regenerative orchard. Let's go across the street, hammer it in, take it out. One that doesn't have any cover crop, doesn't have probably not as many. They're not grown regeneratively, but really it's that cover crop. Pull it out, it is like half because the water just runs off of it.
I've done, so there's a wheat field right across the street from my house.
Okay.
I know the guy that farms it. Mm-hmm. I know the people that own it. I've snuck over there and done a water infiltration test, and it's less than a half inch an hour most of the time.
Do they listen to this podcast?
No. No, they don't. If I know somebody's listening, I try not to talk crap on them. But I've also done moisture infiltration tests out in my pastures.
Yeah.
6 inches an hour.
Yep.
Plus. Like you can't, like almost can't pour the water out as fast as it can get absorbed into the ground. So it's the guys that, you know, Eastern Colorado, Western Kansas. And I think what it is the reason guys out here are more likely to share and come together and have a conference is it sucks. Like, it's hard. It's always hard. And 7 of 10 years out in the plains, you're fighting the weather.
Yeah. Like,
it's either too hot for crops to germinate. It's not getting cool enough at night. We're not getting enough rain, or there's 40 miles an hour wind. And farming and growing crops is real simple when you can make it rain on demand. Like when you have unlimited amounts of water, you know, from free irrigation, whether you're getting out of a ditch or you're getting out of a center pivot sprinkler, when you have all that irrigation water, it's a crutch and it makes things so much easier.
Mm-hmm. But then you also have flooding.
Then you have flooding. I mean, you're talking about the Central Valley of California.
Yeah.
Nation's salad bowl. Great. I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. I like eating strawberries and romaine lettuce and, you know, mm-hmm. there's a few green things that I do eat.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
But I'm thinking more of the Imperial Valley down in Southern California, mm-hmm. where they're using the water they get in the Imperial Valley comes out of the Colorado River, which they pump over two mountain ranges to get to the Imperial Valley, grow crops mm-hmm. in a desert.
Mm-hmm.
Salinas Valley, you guys get your water from the north, kind of like out of the California water system.
Aqueduct.
But my point is, mm-hmm. agriculture gets easier when you get free water, other than what it rains.
Yeah. I mean, we could also go take a hard left right here if you wanted, Brian. I love talking about indoor vertical farming. Hydroponic. You're talking about like farming on demand, controlling the controllables, controlling the elements. I mean.
No, I'm not. I'm not talking about
control. There could be.
Getting away from that control and those inputs. Like, I think the future food system is going to have more waste in it with less energy consumed.
Yeah. You know, we work in hydroponics right now. We've been supporting a fantastic family-owned hydroponic herb farming operation that's in the Coachella Valley, so Imperial, like what we're talking about. We're also hopefully going to start working with a hydroponic lettuce farmer in Nashville. His waste in Nashville is basically zero because it's more predictive farming. He can predictably tell his farming company, his restaurants, his grocery stores, and some his CSA customers, and then also his food pantry customers, like what they're going to get and when they're going to get it, because it's just such a controllable environment. And I mean, I would argue, and there's like, it is zero waste. It is actually zero waste. It's all solar. It's pretty special. I would argue that, you know, I believe in local, like I'm a local war, right? And I get the luxury of being a local war. I also, with a biodiversity, like, you know, the most diverse palette I have being sitting exactly where I am in California. Even on our own family farm, we grow 10 different specialty crops. But that's where I think that we're just going to continue to see cheaper and cheaper ways to grow food indoor throughout areas that are urban and or snow, you know, snow belts, so that people can get the biodiversity because they want it. I think that we're going to see a big shift in that. I think it's going to become cheaper to run those operations because of the robots are cheaper. The labor's more easier educated, you know, all that.
But, okay. So there's some great points there. And the one question I would have, has there been nutrient density studies done on, let's just say, pick whatever hydroponic or aquaponic or aeroponic crop that you want that's a zero waste crop? Have we done nutrient density studies on that versus the same thing that was grown outdoors in the sunshine, in nature, in soil, with, you know, all the microbes and the fungi and the bacteria in the soil, with all the healthy exchange of root exudates? I mean, I could go on, but you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
Do we know what the nutrient density difference is between that hydroponically grown produce and naturally grown produce of the same type?
I would imagine that has been done because we wouldn't have seen tens and tens of billions of dollars invested in this without that. I mean, this was a darling of the ag tech VC world, 2020, even I think 2019. Since has shifted, like, you know, ag tech investments since have shifted significantly, but I think that we're going to continue to see this. I mean, I'm contacted all the time by farmers from the other day, I got a strawberry farmer in Calgary. He has an Amazon Whole Foods contract to grow strawberries in Calgary to feed like the, you know, that side of Canada.
Interesting. The other thing I think about when we're, you know, talking about vertical farming and indoor farming, it's the energy use, and not just the energy use that was required to replace sunlight. I mean, we got to pump the water, the nutrients that you're putting in the solution, they've got to come from somewhere. And all that infrastructure has to be built. Mm-hmm. You know, there's obviously a cost there. And most of the piping and plumbing in those things would all be plastic.
Possibly.
I mean, if it's not plastic, it's metal, which you can't make that without a fantastic investment in hydrocarbons to either make the plastic or make the metal pipe. Mm-hmm. And I mean, forgive me. I mean, I'm not saying that couldn't be a possible way forward. I'm just questioning the energy and infrastructure investment that takes, and is that really ecologically responsible to be doing in the long run?
Versus hauling trucks all over the country?
Granted, that's a point. And
the other thing, remember, Brian, is in these more controlled farming environments, you're controlling the amount of UV that is being radiated, which technically means they're mostly organic, like certifiably organic, because you do not need as many pesticides. Now, and again, remember, I just see all the sides here because we farm a large conventionally grown farm. So I get it. Like we have a spraying business. We have custom spraying business. Like I get all of it, but I just think there's something to be said for evolution and giving consumers opportunity to choose. I think that's what the future of farming is. Decommoditizing food.
Yes, I can get behind that statement 100%. Let's decommoditize the food.
You cannot do that unless companies are willing to create brands and the brands are willing to educate the consumers, because gone are the days of the associations doing it. The least powerful all of the associations are right now, especially because they're not even buying groups.
What are just associations?
Oh, the California Association for this, the councils, all of like the associations that, quite frankly, farmers are being tacked. Like there's like the assessment checkoff, I think in the Midwest they're called checkoff dollars that go in, like per, here they're called assessments, like per bushel, per pound, per bag. And those are going to the associations. The associations don't know what to do right now.
From my experience, the NCBA beef checkoff, I would rather not ever give them another dollar until they started saying things that I agreed with and could understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cattlemen Association, California Dry Bean Advisory Board. I think a lot of the Almond Board of California, the Walnut Commission. I mean, there's just a lot of questions right now. And I think those questions really start flying when the price is in the toilet.
I mean, do any of those associations do anything other than lobby government?
Well, they're supposed to be educating farmers, I think, on best practices. They also do, I think most of their budgets go to research. I mean, there's promotional budgets also. You know, that's something that we bid on all the time. We're constantly replying to RFPs.
When I see the beef checkoff advertising in Beef Magazine that's circulated to cattlemen, I wonder why we're advertising. Why are we preaching to the choir?
Like, it's because they want to make you feel good about it. But wouldn't you rather have that money gone to spend towards like actually promoting something? But the problem is they can't promote a brand.
Right.
They just promote beef raised in Kansas is better for you and you should do it. And actually they're not even supposed to say anything competing. Like they're like in California through the California Marketing Order through the CDFA, you're not supposed to say like there's more fiber in beans than blueberries. Like you can't, you're not supposed to even compare against another crop. You're not supposed to compare against another state. I'm not supposed to say beans grown in California are better for you than beans growing in Colorado. Like you're not allowed to say that.
I would just like them to say, this is product of USA and this is not. Like, let's just make that distinction with our meat. Like,
I think we're going to see that consolidation. I think that's part of like people getting real mad about like being checked, because the truth is like, why do we have the big national associations and then also the state associations, when the state associations are then probably paying dues or membership to the national one? So again, I think to your point, that's the lobbyists, and then trying to like probably do some sort of international lobbying as well.
That's one of the things that checkoff likes to say is, oh, we're using your dollars to promote beef overseas. We're trying to grow the export market. Mm-hmm. Well, when they show you the export market chart that's pretty flat, then they show you the beef imports and it's going up, you kind of wonder about, really, whose exports are you trying to promote? Nigerian exports to the United States? Brazilian beef to the United States? Is that what you're promoting? Anyway,
especially when now the brands are just, again, back to a point I think we talked about 45 minutes ago, is like brands that are progressive, who have really an amazing pulse on what consumers want, are going straight to the farmers. They don't care what association you're in. They just want to make sure that this is the best product we can possibly source for our brand. And then they're getting contracts. And so then the farmer's like, okay, I've got a contract with this brand that has, you know, I actually basically have a down payment to farm for the next 5 years. Why do I need to pay? I don't want to pay those checkoff dollars. I don't need to do it. I've already got a buyer. Yeah. I mean, in theory, the associations, I can see why they were built. I can see why they were made in like that post-war era. I get it. But now we've just got a whole different way to educate consumers and consumer expectations and consumer voice. And you've got, and they have questions.
We have social media. We have podcasts. We have independent media and independent journalism that's not controlled by land-grant universities, ABC, CBS, or NBC.
Yeah, exactly. That's where they.
And the information can be out there. However,
yeah,
we're leaving more up to the consumer to make their own educated decision.
Yeah.
Which can be part of a problem because critical thinking skills are severely lacking for a lot of people.
Or they're just focused on what they're going to focus on. I don't know.
So tell me about Project Gigatron.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, for sure. Project Gigatron was started in 2017 by Walmart. And I really only know about Project Gigatron in the produce sect. I don't know about it in regards to other crops, but it was really in 2017, Walmart said, you know what, we are making all these claims about our sustainability goals, our ESG goals. We want to be part of climate. And what do we have that we control? We control access, right, as the largest retailer in the country. And so what we can do to put our money behind like where our mouth is that we can require very specific climate control, like climate forward and climate enhancing requirements for our produce suppliers. So they're looking at through Project Gigatron, a produce company will then go, and I think it's 104 checkoff points they have to address, from energy, waste, packaging, transportation, product use and design, and really just on-farm practices. Many cases, water. I think that they also taking into account water. And that's where... And I think that the due date every year annually is like November 4th or something, which is an ominous day, right? And that way, elections.
That was all I could come up with, too.
And then if you go through Project Gigatron and you get certified, you then are going to be on our supplier list and we will buy your crop from you and it will be sold and distributed at Walmarts around the country or in different regions or whatever. And this really pinches the little guy, full disclosure, but it also has created some very climate forming farming like processes that are sustainably driven at like large scale. So Project Gigatron, and there are consultants out there who help farmers get through it, who help them make recommendations, how they can appease that checklist. But I think that this is really, I always say shockingly, if you want to buy the most sustainably grown, honestly, ethically grown produce on the market, it's actually at Walmart, which I think blows a lot of people's mind. At scale. I'm talking about food at scale. This is eat out of your garden or your CSA where you know Bob, the farmer. And your farmer's market, that's all like number one. But number two at scale is Walmart.
And that just does absolutely blow my mind.
I know. I get it. It's crazy.
And I'm not sure how I feel about that because large corporate, large corporate America. Like, and yeah, it's just large corporate America. I was sitting here thinking about, you know, how many of those dollars get back to the farmer versus, you know, through a more conventional system, thinking about Dollar General, how Dollar General kind of kills economies, kills towns. And Walmart did the same thing to a lot of towns in the 80s and 90s. And we just didn't really, we didn't know what was happening. We weren't aware enough that it was happening, but Walmart killed a lot of things on Main Street. It really, and when they started getting into food, what was that 15, 16 years ago when Walmart started selling food? I mean, it wasn't overnight, but a lot of small towns that got a super Walmart that started selling food 15 years ago don't have a grocery store now. And now, instead of having two grocery stores and a meat market, they've got a Walmart and a Dollar General.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they don't have a sponsor for their local Little League teams. Like, I get it. Like, that's just, that's unfortunately what's, I think that's what's happened. I think Walmart primed us all for Amazon.
Yeah.
Right?
I just want to say that if anybody over the last 4 years had a problem with Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk launching rockets, let's just go look at all the crap we bought from Amazon and look at all the Teslas on the road.
Yeah. I agree with you. I agree. So, but again, back to food at scale. You know, I mean, Brian, if cheaper access to high quality, biodiverse, nutritional food like produce is going to help people that live in food deserts live a healthier, more nutritious lifestyle, allowing for better reproductive opportunities, mental health, healthier, then I mean, I hate to say it, but I think I'm for it, you know?
For what?
Like, I'm for these kinds of, you know, the Project Gigatron example. Kroger's not that far behind. Aldi's not that far behind. Publix, all the retailers, all are putting ESG claims out there and requirements of their suppliers. And that's part of our job at Noble West, is to help our clients write, develop marketing strategies around what they're already doing right. You know, what they're already doing right on farm or in their processing plants or in their mills, so that they can get more credit from it. And also more credit, meaning like the retailer is seeing like the good work they're doing, is going to pay their premium dollar for it. The salesperson of our clients has more tools in their toolkit to say, we can give you social media content. We can give you a campaign. We will partner with you on this to show that the tomatoes grown here and processed here are actually ladder up to whatever, you know, Kraft's goals are, which then ladder up. So then Kraft is enabled to help their retailers hit their ESG goals as well. So it's just, I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a cry for more information that they can give consumers. I think we're seeing less of a vacuum, which has just created more skepticism probably, right? But it's also hopefully improve the food system and improve better nutrition for the masses.
One of the biggest lessons that I've learned in the last 4 years, and I've heard this from several other people, is the successful agricultural operation. Can I back up? In 2030, the successful ag operations are the ones telling their stories today.
And how are they getting compensated for that?
I mean, maybe they're not getting compensated for telling their story yet, but they're putting it out there, and it's in the public conversation, I guess. You know, I think back to the 30s. Like, what did it take to get Congress to actually move on soil conservation in the 30s? The dust storms had to get bad enough, and the weather just happened to line up that dust cloud made it to Washington, D.C. You know, and I think about this past fall in Illinois, of all places, they had dust storms so bad that there were fatal wrecks on the highways. Like, so much dust blowing over the highway, people couldn't see, and there was a couple fatalities. I'm not trying to make light of that. I'm trying to use that as like, hey, this is a wake-up call. Like, roads are constantly being shut down in western Kansas and eastern Colorado because of blowing dust and reduced visibility. And they throw cautions out all the time. Like, hey, maybe don't go drive today because the wind's 50 miles an hour and the dust's going to be blowing. And that comes back to us. That lands right back on us as farmers and ranchers and taking care of our soil and leaving our soil naked. Mm-hmm. Right? But there's no like larger will to save soil and to keep it covered and prevent dust from blowing around. Everybody's got an excuse. Well, that's how you have to grow corn out here. You have to, you have to leave it fallow or chemical fallow it or do whatever. We can't have a cover crop. That just doesn't work. And fighting against all these, it's just uphill battle of things that people think they know based on outdated information.
And whose job is it to educate those farmers and get them to listen?
It should be their job to be a lifelong learner and to strive to always do better. But I think a lot of them are content to lay in the hammock that is the safety net of crop insurance and continue doing things the way they've always been done, the way they were taught to do in college. Mm. You know what the seven most dangerous words in agriculture are, right?
Oh, tell me.
We have always done it this
way. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
that's why, like, respecting tradition, like that, I think that's where that's like the crux of Noble West. That's what I put all over the place. Like, I'm going to respect tradition. Obviously, there's nobody I respect more than my, five generations of men and women who got us to this point on this farming the same land that we farm today. But like, that's not what's going to get us there. What got us here is not going to get us there. Like, I'm sorry. Those days are done. Even 20, 30 years ago, labor. My goodness, all of it. But like, the one thing is, I hear you. I think that like, yeah, saying they should just want to do better for better sake. You know what you're talking about? A lot of people that have worked a lot of hard days, who have invested skin, who every single year risk everything to try to do it again with no expectation of a handout. And to say they want to do better for better sake is, I get it. Maybe if you've got like some golden parachute somewhere else, which like 97% of all farms are family owned, they don't have those. And unless they're getting paid, like actually paid, like you use like the keep it fallow for a season. So then like this, just rip the topsoil off. Unless they're getting paid for a nitrogen fixing cover crop, like I don't get it why they would. Like, I just feel like we can't expect farmers to make decisions for the good unless they're going to be compensated for it, because that's just how everything else works.
I mean, and you have a point.
I mean, do I sound like a soul crushing human when I say that?
When the only way to get somebody to do something is financially incentivize it, then everything has to be financially incentivized. And who pays for that? That's where I get to, okay? Programs are great. Somebody's got to pay for it. And where does that money come from? So they can either do what they've been doing, which is just continue to invent money, which causes inflation, devalues our currency, all that stuff. Or, I guess that's really the only way.
That's not the only way. Now you sound like a cynical farmer, Brian, which is okay. I pigs want to know one, but that's not the only way. That is a way that I just would say, like, that's a cop out a little bit. What the other way is that we expect more of food brands. We educate consumers about like diversifying their diet, and we find a home for those cover crops. The yellow pea example with General Mills. That is like in a mainstream stage, that is the conversation with mainstream brands. I would argue that's what associations should be spending their time on. Using their network and using that Rolodex to try to find ways to find homes for cover crops. That is where we would see actual climate change.
I mean, for everything that I've said, you have a tremendous point. Like, that's what it takes. That's what it's going to take most farmers to change, is they're going to have to feel financial pressure from some way, whether it's a carrot from a new program or it's a stick from the banker saying, if you don't do something different, I'm taking your farm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think for a lot of operators, it's going to have to be a carrot or stick approach, and they're not going to see the benefits of investing in a more regenerative system until they're presented with either a carrot or a stick.
I don't disagree with you. The other thing is, I mean, I don't know what labor is like for you guys in the Midwest, but out here, holy cow, it's the conversation. I mean, we have minimum wage.
Oh, yeah.
Wage in the mid-20s.
Oh, yeah.
Per hour. Like, for us, like I think I mentioned, my husband and I, we have a custom farm. We farm our own land, and then we also have a custom farm management and harvesting business for tree nuts. Over my dead body, is he going to run that crew on a Sunday? Like, over my dead body, we are not paying double overtime. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, we're not going to pay our operator, even though we love them, we're not going to pay them $60 an hour. Like, we can't.
How many of those specialty crops, they're in the Salinas Valley, that are not insurable?
Central Valley, too. Don't forget about Central Valley. That's where I am.
Okay, sorry, Central Valley. Like, yeah. Just your context.
Yeah.
All these, quote, specialty crops that they grow there. How many of them can they harvest mechanically?
Okay.
Or do they need a lot of labor to harvest and package those crops? So where I'm going with this is, I don't think food should be cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Food should not be cheap. Food is fucking hard. It's hard to get. It's energy and labor intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And when we replace human labor with oil energy and oil-powered machines in our food systems, the math doesn't change.
Yeah, a lot of those are soil. A lot of those are solar, though.
But the math doesn't change.
Yeah. Well, okay. So to answer you, so in California, per the acreage, per the CDFA annual report, 400 specialty crops are grown and sold from California. So, no. Are a lot of those farm? So to answer your question, like, again, we're specialists in almond and tree nuts. So we, on my own farm, we grow almonds, we grow walnuts. Down the street is pistachios. We also grow apricots. We also have cherries. Those, so walnuts and almonds are all harvested mechanically, and they use the same equipment. Pistachios, very similar equipment, not exactly the same. But as far as hand labor, I think you have the robots in the field. I mean, I don't know how many people have been studying robots, but robots are very common to be seen in fields. Laser weeders, increasing, which is helpful for especially organics. There's laser weeders. There is lots of harvesting. We've always had, we grow tomatoes. I grew up working on the tomato harvester. When I was a child, there was about 12 people on the harvester hand sorting as it was going down through the field. Now it's all mechanical. I think there's two or three operators on the tomato harvester. The place where we really, I don't see us getting away from it, although there is innovation, but in the berries, like those are primarily all hand harvested. Melons. Like, again, my family is a big melon growing family. Melons, they're from the vine. Guys throw them up on the conveyor belt. They get processed. They get packed in the heart. They're field packed.
I was having visions of robots running around picking tomatoes, and I was thinking, about how far you are from Bay Area, how many people that those robots are replacing, and how many hungry homeless people are in the Bay Area.
Oh, God. Yeah, but those folks aren't going to be the ones harvesting the food. They don't want that job.
I get that.
You know that.
I get that. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
We do kind of need to wrap up.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's been almost 2 hours already.
Kicking the tires. I am leaning back, by the way.
See, you didn't think that we'd be able to go this long, but here we are. What are we going to talk about? I don't know. We'll figure it out.
I feel like I have lots more things to talk about. I feel like we should have a whole episode just on upcycling and what it's going to mean for farmers, but we can do that another time.
We might have to do that. All right. So we are Noble West. Where do we find you? What do you guys do? What's your sales pitch?
I'm not going to do my sales pitch to a cynical farmer and an audience of cynical farmers, for goodness sakes. You're going to have to discover that on your own so you know that it really exists.
Fair enough.
We are noblewest.com, and then Instagram is We Are Noble West. And then I'm on LinkedIn. My name's Allie Cox. Those are the best ways to find us.
Okay. Anything else we forgot covered today?
No, let's just find more value for the hardware farmers already do.
I'm all about that. Finding more value for farmers and putting more of the consumer's food dollar back in the farmer and rancher's pocket.
Because you actually get the consumers what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. But they got to know what they want.
They know what they want. Don't give consumers the hard consumer insights. Consumer insight marketing does not make it to farmers, and it should. Farmers should know what consumer insights are. That's the information they should be paying their associations for.
Yeah. Are you listening, Beef Checkoff?
I can't have any friends anymore after this. We check off in that space.
Well, that's okay. It's probably nothing new for me. All right, Allie Cox. Been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for joining me today. And gang, we'll see you.